Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Michelle identifies as a Gumbanya Yagal Niami, woman in Gumbanya, accepted on Bunjalung country. Hopefully I pronounced it that close to or as right as I could, and apologise if I didn't. Michelle champions social justice and seeks to work hard to increase equality and equity for First Nations peoples. As a targeted early intervention worker with Bugle Wernby TEI program Tabulum District, Michelle leads with an Indigenous feministic practice, authentic Aboriginal leadership and Aboriginal governance, which self-empowers to show up with and for community. Today we talk about the challenges of the work Michelle has been a part of, the power of Aboriginal people working with Aboriginal people, and her passion for early intervention with children to help build strong families within the community. Welcome, Michelle. Michelle Laurie, thanks so much for joining me and having a chat with me. I appreciate the time.
You're welcome.
Michelle, tell our listeners, whereabouts are you from? What country do you come from with your mom?
My name's Michelle Laurie. I'm a Yagal and a Gumbanya woman. My dad's a Yagal man from Pippi Beach, grew up on the Mish. And my mum's from South Grafton, south of the Clarence River, and very connected to Namboida.
Yeah, beautiful country.
Deadly spiritual country.
Where did you grow up? Which part? And yeah, how was it for you growing up?
Up in Sydney, out west, Doonside, Knox Road, Housing Commission.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to run a muck down there.
Did you?
Yeah. Loved it. Did my primary schooling down there and moved up back to country when Nan was unwell, as you do. You know, you find yourself returning home and Dad come back home and reconnected with family and those, you know, family obligations and responsibilities kicking in and as a key part of the decision making to move back home. And high school at Grafton High. Yeah, and pretty much just left Grafton High. Left Grafton not too long after finishing school for big opportunities.
Yeah. And so professionally, what have you been up to since you left high school?
My first job was while I was at high school. My first job ever was cutting and washing lettuce for $5 an hour, which was great for me.
On the lettuce farm?
On the lettuce farm.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, I used to wait for the little ding. Used to wait on the back porch for my girlfriend and hear the ding of her bike as she'd come around the corner. And I used to, that was my little indication to go down the back steps and jump on my dragster. And we used to ride to the lettuce farm before school and wait for the sun to come up and then go home and get ready for school.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you obviously learnt the value of a dollar at a young age.
Yeah.
Was that common amongst your circle of friends?
I don't think I knew of any other, really too many other students that in my year that really committed to that.
So you were wanting to get ahead, saving, and then where did you go from working the lettuce farm?
From there, continued schooling, and then in my senior years, my second job was still in while I was at high school. I worked at Dobie Della fast takeaway shop. And I got double per hour what I got at the lettuce farm, so I thought it was pretty cool and I was making the money. So I was still engaged in school because mum and dad, if you haven't got a decent job that earns you money that will build a career for you, you stay at school and get your HSC. Yeah. So I was doing a bit of both and finding my way through that, learning about life and the value of commitment, dedication, money, and trying to sort myself out as to what I needed to do, you know, next steps.
And did you have a large family, Michelle?
I've got a twin sister, older sister, baby brother.
Yeah.
And mum and dad still live down home on country. My older sister does. My brother's moves up and down the coast a fair bit. He's a song man and he's really truly connected to culture, especially out at Namboida, where my great-great-grandfather is a very spiritual man who was a Featherfoot, very powerful man back in the day. So, and my twin and I live in Lismore.
Yeah.
Yeah, with our families.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
And so how did you get into the work you're doing at the moment? How did you get into that?
I left high school and started my nursing. So I finished my qualification in nursing, travelled to Sydney and back, worked at Grafton Base, got married after my first child, thought, you know what, I can't, you know, bring my child up here. I wanted something different. So my husband and I at the time moved up to the Tweed Coast. And from there, I engaged in further learning at Kingscliff TAFE and got to know the Aboriginal Student Support Officer, and he was on his way out progressing to a higher role, and he said, look, I think you'd be really great at this job. Why don't you think about applying for it? So applied for that in the student support role. I was successful in that, and I was like 14, 15 years in the TAFE system, working in TAFE system supporting Aboriginal community with education, learning and connection to employment.
Wow, so that's so helping kids get access to the education they need in order for them to be employed.
Yeah.
And how did you find over your time doing that? How have you found that and the challenges associated with that role?
I found the young people that were coming, I was feeling trusted enough for them to disclose broader experiences that they were having within the home context. And that then broadened my thinking around, you know, this holistic kind of support that young people that were coming to TAFE were really looking for. So the support with just education was broadened into a range of other kinds of supports that they needed to help them be on campus and to learn. So then I got to understand, and I was really curious around, well, if someone is set up well in a home context and has everything that they need, they're going to thrive in their education. So I continued to witness young people either engaging, disengaging, having a pattern of that and not completing because of other factors in their life.
Yeah.
Yeah, weren't there. Yeah. So that holistic kind of point of view and that holistic health that and the determinants of health, the determinants of well-being, the cultural determinants. That's when I started to really take note of that, and I was curious to that, and I left education into going to Brighter Futures and being a family support worker, and I was supporting families in the context of their family and supporting with a whole facet of support needs. And that's when I stepped into my own power and my own passion in that sense. So that's where I felt like I could really contribute, and I had the compassion and the care for families, children, young people, building the capacity of parents and walking alongside to help the families know their potential.
Yeah. And that was, so, I mean, your time at TAFE, you're really looking at it thinking, well, hang on, it's not the fact that these kids aren't good enough or don't deserve the opportunity. It's the fact that these other support structures around them were probably impacting their ability to actually go and attend to get the training or the education.
Yeah. Where it was from through other people's eyes, it was like, oh, these young people aren't interested.
Yeah.
You know, they're just disengaging.
Yeah.
But it's like, what is actually impacting their ability to be here?
Yeah.
You know, and people not asking the right questions.
So as you went to Brighter Futures, I guess you're in a role there where you had a better opportunity to help actually create some meaningful change and help with those support networks. And was a large focus of that family?
Large focus on that was family, definitely. And while I was Brighter Futures, I was encouraged to start my formal learning with ECAV, New South Wales Health, and take a real specific cultural focus on family wellbeing, and enrolled into a Certificate 3 in family wellbeing, Aboriginal family wellbeing, and that started a triggered off a really beautiful and life-changing pathway to learning and bringing me closer to being really knowledgeable and experienced with having deep conversations with other Aboriginal peoples and being humbled in the space to learn from around the complexity around Aboriginal living for families. That's where my passion comes from, for justice, yeah. Truth-telling and healing.
Yeah, I can see you light up when you talk about that.
Yeah.
So you undertook the Aboriginal Wellbeing Certificate, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a Cert 3 in Aboriginal Family Wellbeing.
Yep.
And the next formal learning piece in that pathway was interpersonal trauma specialist counselling.
Mm.
And that's where I felt like I took another leap of faith and started moving closer to understanding trauma physiologically, spiritually, culturally, in all domains of our holistic wellbeing.
Who is this course through again?
It's through the Education Centre Against Violence with New yeah. South Wales Health.
Okay, and you found, were they quite thorough, good courses, culturally appropriate?
It was Aboriginal perspectives.
Oh, great.
And Aboriginal teachers and lecturers.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it was Aboriginal people being in a space of learning from each other.
And so what do you think was the biggest learnings out of that? To understand, yeah, what was your biggest thing that you got out?
I suppose the biggest learning for me is I didn't actually know. When I was, you know, a young child, a kid down in Doonside waiting to get served at the corner shop, understanding that I thought that I would be always served last because other people would go before me. But I think growing up and learning about the context and the legacy of discrimination and racism, actually in how that was an experience for me where I was seen less of and I was dealt with later, and other people that didn't look like me had the floor.
Yeah.
And they had the priority of serve. So the concepts actually then allowed me to pick up childhood experiences.
Yeah.
To place into those concepts and really understand my lived experience around my growing up and the experience. I had a language to articulate to. That, I think, was my biggest learning and the biggest power that I think I have through my formal learning is finding the language and speaking to power, because yeah. that's what it enabled me to do.
Yeah. And so when you were experiencing these things in the moment, though, I mean, you didn't know any different.
No.
It wasn't until the reflection looking back
yes.
and getting the understanding that you realise the discrimination.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
Very powerful though.
Yeah.
To then.
So now that really drives and it influences how I parent my children.
Yeah.
And how I empower other children and young people.
Mm. And you'd hope in this day and age that that's no longer happening. I mean, we'd all hope that that's the case. But do you feel like have we come a little bit of the way since you were a child going through that?
I don't know. The experience is so diverse in different contexts for different mob, you know. So I'm not going to
generalize.
I'm not going to generalize on that one because I hear too many stories of not that happening rather than seeing it happen.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think that was the moments that I thought – that fed into my own self-determination and understanding my role in that to support and empower other members of community in that.
It's sad in this day and age that that's still sort of the case, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like my daughter works in education and she came home last week. She said, "Mum, you know what?" She said, "I've been observing the last few weeks and the Aboriginal kids get treated differently at school."
Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked a little bit about her observations and her thinking around that and really talking about the situational context, but also broadening that into the wider Aboriginal experience of that. Yeah, racism and discrimination is, I suppose, taking really contemporary forms.
It's important to talk about that though, isn't it, with them? So yeah. that they, because obviously they're becoming conscious to this, right?
Yeah.
So to have that opportunity to discuss that.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
And she's picking that up at an earlier age than what I did.
You know?
So the knowledge is there the motivation to understand, hey, this is not fair.
Yeah.
You know, I'm seeing Aboriginal children being treated differently. And talking about her role in calling that out.
Yes.
And her confidence in calling that out. And I said, how are you managing that, Dot? She said, oh, well, I'll just go and talk to the senior Aboriginal worker for now. But I know, Mum, I'll step up.
Mm.
But I've got to just get my confidence first.
Yeah. That's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Michelle, you've been a big supporter, advocate of equality and equity for First Nations people. We have a long way to go, but what's something that you find, at the moment, what's the biggest challenge around that, do you think?
I think the biggest challenge is even the biggest challenge and an unknown challenge for non-Aboriginal people to understand is their own bias and privilege and their unconscious bias. That is the biggest challenge for all of us, I think, because they can't identify that.
Yeah, they're unconscious to it, or it's so subtle.
Or if they're in a space where it's a space challenging or trying to bring the awareness or the insight there, the fragility that comes up with that.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's really difficult to sit in that space with. I've become more acute to it. Yeah, and the challenge is for myself is being psychological safe in that. But also the old people's, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants before us that have really paved the way in human rights and civil rights and race relations, and they've passed the baton on.
Throughout your studies, I mean, you mentioned the certificates that you obtained, but also having a really good understanding of the mental health aspect as it relates to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. How have you found that and actually integrating and using that in the work that you're doing?
First of all, I suppose being really mindful and conscious to influence language around mental health and the, you know, the understanding from Aboriginal people around that, you know. Certainly my understanding of mental health means clinical, it means diagnosis, it means pathologizing, and you've got to fit into the definition of a manual.
Yeah.
Mental health for me is well-being, spiritual, emotional well-being, and for me that's a spiritual wellness, and that's my context of that when I hear other people talk about that. But also, you know, there's now in the DSM-5, and that was that book I was just referring to, they have racial trauma as a definition now. So they're still sort of clinicalizing and pathologizing Aboriginal experience, but still defining it as what they want to define it as.
Yeah, labeling it.
Yeah, which is really still taking away and disconnecting to the concepts of Aboriginal worldviews and ways and concepts of our well-being, which is a holistic well-being. Yeah, so, yeah, it's really difficult. It's really difficult to work with practitioners that support young people and children, and they work in a different modality or they've got a different worldview to Aboriginal worldviews.
Yeah. Is that, you reckon, one of the biggest challenges of trying to get that culturally appropriate ways?
Well, I think, you know what, this conference here has created the space for all those big conversations to be had, and I'll always talk about the legacy of invasion and the legacy that continues to disempower us and how harmful colonialized systems are of services for our people. You know, we know that our mob don't engage in services for many reasons. The racism and discrimination is a big one, you know, and we're here for family and domestic violence, and we need to understand the complexity of that, but also how historical violence feeds into that as well through transgenerational trauma.
Mm.
So I suppose the biggest thing is broadening the worldview, and it's not an individual process. It's so big and it's so broad, and it demands integrated support, and it demands someone to understand and be skillful in supporting Aboriginal families in the way that they need to be supported. And the whole self-determination piece is huge, and that feeds into the well-being aspect as well.
Let's talk a bit about that for our listeners, what that means to you and the people.
Self-determination for me is allowing the space. It means us stepping aside and supporting a family to make their own decision-making around what their needs are, how they need them, when they need them, and what their priorities are.
Mm.
You know, that's just one example.
Yeah.
Self-determination can be utilized through many, many different situations. And, for example, working with remote Aboriginal communities, you know, the self-determination and the community development aspect of that is huge because of the way that historically Aboriginal people have been pushed out of, you know, towns and have been left to their own devices, have not been resourced, housing, electricity, water. So we've got some, you know, living situations that people would be quite shocked at, but they're so disconnected to.
Mm.
And the self-determination piece for me is supporting that community or those families to be really aware around what their needs are, how to get them, their human rights in that, which is foundational to that. Yeah, the human rights piece, you know, access to medical services that actually do not continue to cause harm or create risk of removal of children. You know, our systems and the way that our services work, they're so, I suppose, their definition of unsafety or is very different to ours. You know, the definition of parenting and family are very different to ours. You know, my dad grew up on the Mish at Pippi Beach, and he speaks about these cars driving in because there was only one way in and one way out for cars on the mission there at Yamba, and spoke about when these cars come in, the Aboriginal Protection Board come in, and all the kids would scatter and hide behind the sand dunes because they would come in and judge from their definition of what does it look like to care for a child.
Mm.
They used to actually check the cupboards, check everything in the house. And if they deemed that you weren't caring for your child due to their measures of how they think that children should be cared for, that child would not be staying at the house.
Yeah.
So that's how heightened the fear was of removal.
Mm.
And the self-determination piece with, you know, especially from an organisation from Nunyajarjums who leads with culture, we lead and we work with culture, is that the targeted early intervention work that we're doing now builds family capacity, and the key thing is self-determination. It's allowing communities to dictate to us what their needs are, what is the priority of those needs, how do they want us to work with them, and what is their story of change and how they would like to share the story of change, rather than going to community, letting them know we've got this, this is what we need to do, we've got KPIs here, we need to do this, we need to do that, and you fit in with us. You know, it's flipping that expectation of and way of working to let the community determine how they work with us and what that looks like and what we work on together.
Yes, do you want to tell our listeners what your role is and the role you play in the organisation?
I'm a targeted early intervention worker. And it's a new program. It's a new program area for Nunyajarjums. And I, within my role, visit community like 3 days a week, work out at the health post and at the community hub and engage with community. It's a voluntary program and community engage with us. And if they would like us to support them with family goals, we'll engage and work with each other there. It's around referral and advocacy, but it's also around, you know, support and providing that support in a cultural way that they feel heard, they feel seen, and they are important and their needs are important. So working in that culturally trauma-informed way as well, but very, very conscious of myself being a visitor in that community and my own power in holding, understanding my own privilege there as well, and understanding my own entitlement is also a part of that safety that comes with an Aboriginal person working with other Aboriginal people being off country.
Yeah. people that are coming to seek support or seek some help when you're in community on country, do you find that the people sort of, some people are hesitant, they're worried about wanting to come forward in front of others on community? Is there any stigma associated with wanting to get help seeking?
Look, there's a few reasons why some community might be reluctant or will take a little bit of time to engage. And those reasons could include reasons of trust.
Yeah.
Although I'm an Aboriginal woman who they're probably familiar with my surname. But, you know, I am being observed and I wouldn't want it any other way, because communities need to understand who's coming into their community and whether they can trust them or not.
Yeah.
And that's our way, you know. And it's the invitation piece that's important for me, you know, that provides me with a level of community are open for me to come here and the program and the organisation to be here to support. I've had, you know, families, members of families come and suss me out 1 week, and then the next week they're coming up to sign for the program and they'll talk to each other around, yeah, is this one, you know, what's she like? Is she good? Is she helpful? So, you know, it's a whole part of the building the trust piece, you know, which I know plays out. I just need to keep showing up.
Yeah. And not having someone different every time.
Not having someone consistency. Every, that's right. It's the relationship that needs to. And although funding contracts may be, have a life, a shelf life, the relationships don't.
Yes.
Yeah. It's really important.
Yeah. That's a good distinction.
Relationship-based work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with that new program, you're seeing some good success. Are you seeing, by whatever definition you're calling success, are you seeing more uptake? Are you seeing?
Definitely seeing more engagement. Not quite sure that I can define what success looks like. I haven't had the length of time to work with families to ask them what their success looks like or whether they've felt like they've had success with anything yet. But for me as a worker, the engagement and the level of engagement for me indicates that I've got a level of success and achievement there, and it's the engagement that is important to me.
Yeah. How big is the area that you're looking after?
Probably about 60 households at the most. It ebbs and flows, you know. Yeah. The Tabulan District area is pretty big, big, and there's majority representation of Aboriginal families.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about the interpersonal trauma and how you've, from what you've learned with that, how you're using that in the work that you do to try and identify different things that you think need to it.
I think this is really important for the experience of the families that we work with, is making sure that we're very conscious around not using dynamics practices that mimic other service experiences that have caused harm. I think what we work really conscious of doing is working with community and families at their own pace, not judging. And I think myself walking in, identifying as an Aboriginal woman, brings a level of comfort and security for them where they can, you know, put their guards down and understand, you know, I'll have some cultural understanding and context without judgment in that. And I think that's a really big piece to feeling safe for families to engage with me, because that turnaround is pretty quick where they're asking 1 week around, you know, exploring what's the, you know, I've seen it come out, is she all right, and blah, blah, blah. And then the next week they're actually coming and they're signing up. So the very fact, I think, that I'm Aboriginal, I'm very open and I'm transparent. I identify who I am and I acknowledge that, you know, I'm a mother too. And I think people knowing my family name also is a big connection for them.
That's a big part in Indigenous communities, isn't it? Because, you know, like the tribes have their names and their identities, and there's a certain level of trust and respect.
Yeah, the family names, you know, if you're in a well-known family name, it pretty feels like you've already got a level of trust there.
Yeah.
And I really do feel like, you know, there's already been aunties out there in the Tabulan District that have identified, you know, that they're really close with, you know, my aunties, and I feel like because I'm their niece, I feel like I've already got a foot in the door.
Yeah.
Because they're trusting me in that sense, because they know the family. But then that freaks me out, because I've got my aunties to also be accountable to.
What a great thing though to be able to do.
Yeah.
What early intervention with, especially with the focus around the kids.
Yeah.
Tell me why that's something that means so much to you. Where's that come from, that passion?
Oh, look, you know what? And we're not surprised by the rates of child removal, Aboriginal children being removed from their families. It feels like, you know, we have the opportunity to build capacity and strength and confidence in our families to really enable the care environment that a child needs and the connection to country, the connection to culture. And I think we've got the ability to make sure that we're building strong families so they don't come into the interests of, you know, DCJ. So we're building capacity and we're diverting, you know.
Yeah.
Diverting. So it's an opportune process of, and the program offers that opportunity for us to engage with families to help them identify where their strengths already are.
Mm.
And to bring in those little bits of support to really strengthen them so they're actually not seen on the radar of DCJ and not at the risk of being removed.
And tell me, Michelle, tell me around the value of having Indigenous people in the workforce and how that helps you make progress, you know, and get cut through in the community quicker.
Yeah. Certainly, Aboriginal people working with Aboriginal people's the most powerful thing that I've ever felt. And I feel like through my responsibilities and obligations and my love and my care for our Jarjum, so our children, that's where I need to be. But I think the benefit for me is presenting as an Aboriginal person, actually being known in community, is something that other Aboriginal people really accept and they open up and they feel a trust and they feel a safety with. They know that I come with my own Aboriginal experience. And I think what I do is I'm very transparent and I'm very open. And I'm strong in my presentation and I'm strong in the work that I do with families.
Mm.
And they can see the commitment that I have in wanting the best for them.
Yeah.
Whatever that looks like for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that person-centered approach is important, isn't it? So not to be told what it is for them, but to ask them and then just help them.
Totally.
Yeah.
I'm privileged to be in the role that I'm in. I'm privileged to travel to community and be honoured to be welcomed and invited to be there. So it's all about my obligation, the invitation, my obligation and my privilege in the space that I'm in to actually agitate and influence systems change for families when I know Aboriginal people and the families that I work with are being treated unfairly or not accessing due to inequities. And also, you know, Aunt Miriam Rose talks about Dadiri, and that's a really deep, deep, deep listening. So Aboriginal people come with this deep listening ability to come in and sit with and on country and listen to what families need, listen to country, listen to the old people and ancestry. Listening to the stories, and our obligations sit there as well. So there's unseen obligations that we have. The deep listening aspect is something that I think Aboriginal people bring to other Aboriginal people, and sitting in that injustice, sitting in that inequity and sitting in grief and pain is a powerful thing. And because we do that, we can actually move forward together through that, and that solidifies the relationships as well, and that is self-determining in itself.
Yeah.
You know, we have a trainee who was identified through our elders in the district, so we didn't take a mainstream non-Aboriginal white fella way of recruiting. You know, we really took the advice of and the lead from, you know, the elders in that community, because that's old way. They see and they pass on, you know, the rites of passage of young people when they're ready to be taught certain things.
Mm.
So, you know, our trainee was selected by our elders out there, and she's on, and when we're looking at the community capacity building. So there's nothing also more powerful than having young people from that community building capacity for themselves and others, and that for that community. They're living on place and space all the time, you know. So that is a really big part of how we need to be looking at building communities as well. And, I mean, I say to my kids, you know, education is powerful and education is the key. But what's more powerful in education is when you're sharing education and you're sharing what you've learned onto others.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's the model that we would like to see in that.
Michelle, as you look to the future, what would excite you most about the space that you're in at the moment and where things are heading?
I think what excites me more is seeing those little jarjums that are out in community with their parents coming and engaging and having the conversations that we're starting to have around what they want for their families, what they want for their kids, and what they want for their community. And for them to share that with me when I'm off country, and they trust me enough to have those yarns because they know I'm their goodwilled and I come with the right motivations there to sit with them and for them to entrust in me, for me to be a part of their journey in that.
Yeah.
That's what I get excited about. And then I get excited about going back to work and having these big conversations around challenging systems and processes, you know, with my manager, and we take up organisational systems change work, you know.
Yeah.
So working on the ground grassroots and then using my role and my ability and my scope of influence then to come back and challenge systems that I see that are there that impact our communities.
And the fact that you have that flexibility to be able to change that, I mean, is a real big positive as well.
Yeah, well, the challenging power, but also sitting in my truth-telling. Truth-telling for me is a part of change and it's a part of healing. So we can't have truth-telling without justice and then we get healing. So, you know, the bigger concept of healing includes truth-telling and getting justice for Aboriginal people.
Beautifully put. Michelle, as we start winding it up, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they reach out?
They can contact me through Nunya Jarjum's website, through just the general inquiries potentially, or email me as well, direct, if that was appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah, so michelle.daly@nunyajarjums.com.
Perfect. Michelle, is there anything you want to say in closing, anything you want to mention or anything that we didn't get a chance to touch on that you want to?
No, look, I think because I work for NJs and we're a community-controlled organisation, is also a big piece of the puzzle as to why community are so open with the invitations for us to go in and help.
Mm.
You know, the emphasis on building capacity and resourcing Aboriginal community-controlled organisations so we could step forward and offer the services that we have the expertise in for community to engage with is huge, and that is a really big part of the change story ahead of us, is we need to be, you know, taken seriously. And seeing that we are a real valuable piece of the puzzle of Aboriginal empowerment and closing the gap in all those areas, those priority areas.
Mm. Beautifully put. Michelle, thanks so much for spending some time with me. I appreciate that, and sharing some amazing insights with our listeners. Thanks for taking the time, and we wish you all the best in the future and can't wait to hear more.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.